Well, Malcolm Holine is with us, and I don't know, Ken Friedman and I are going to be asking each other later today if we've been the victim of a radio stunt, because yesterday Malcolm called me from Morocco and specifically gave me instructions that under no circumstances could I reveal his location, where he is, in what country he's traveling. And then apparently, according to people who've been calling the radio station this morning after I announced that, apparently, he got on some overnight graveyard shift radio show somewhere last night and actually revealed that he's in Morocco. So we're going to get to the bottom of this and see if we are victims of what we call a radio stunt here at JM in the AM. Mr. Holine, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Yeah, good morning to you.
So what happened between 3 p.m. Eastern time yesterday when I spoke to you and midnight last night that actually allowed you to reveal where you were?
Well, let's just say that it was revealed, and once it was revealed, then it's okay. So it was actually just in the early days for other reasons, because of certain meetings, that we didn't reveal where it was. But now I'm in a place called Bali, Belize,
wow,
which is actually not part of the Olympics, but it's a 2,000-year-old Roman ruins overlooking the most magnificent site right near Meknes, and having come from Medina, but not the Medina. Medina here is, in each city there is a section called the Medina, but that's where the word comes from. But it was in Fez. And all of these places have immense Jewish history, and cemeteries with many prominent rabbis are going back 1,000 years. And more. The Jewish community here is
Malcolm. I'm gonna ask you to pick up our backup line, which is probably about to ring where you are, because we are having a lot of trouble understanding exactly. Okay, hang on a second. All right, Malcolm, you there?
Yes, sir.
All right, this is much better. So do the quick review for us. So you're now exactly where?
A place called Bala Belize, which is near Meknes, and I came from Fez, a place called Medina, which is where word comes from, but it's not the Medina.
Right.
It's a section where near the government offices. This place is a 2,000-year-old Roman ruin, and as you know, each of these cities has a rich Jewish history going back to the expulsion of Jews from at the time of the burning of the Second Temple, some say even earlier. And each city has had a huge Jewish history. There was, at one time, many hundreds of thousands of Jews living here. Today there are only about 5,000 Jews, but they still have a rich Jewish life, and tens of thousands of Moroccan Jews come back to visit here each year.
Whenever we hear about increased security, and I mean, obviously you're a high-profile person, so it's a little bit different in your case, but when we hear about the quote-unquote protection that a government like Morocco gives to the Jewish community and how concerned they are about that area, so obviously it makes us think that otherwise people would be in danger. Do you get that feeling as you tour the country?
Not at all. The Jewish community does not feel that way. In many places, you have less security than you have, let's say, in some of the capitals of Europe. Jews feel very secure. Everybody here talks about some Jewish connection in their family, their history, relationships, not blood relationships, but familial relationships, communal involvements. Everybody knows about kashrus, the way people have extended themselves for us, and we do have security, but frankly, I don't feel any need for it. It's really quite remarkable.
And because it seems that airline ticket prices is the news of the week, true or false, that a round trip to Morocco is $29. Is that true or not, Malcolm?
Only on JetBlue. But I say I can't complain about the airline thing, because my children benefited from it. But and I see that El Al announced that they're going to honor it. Air Maroc has not announced that they're going to honor those El Al special deals.
Well, I would guess not. All right, Malcolm Holine is in Morocco, and we have a lot to talk about because it's been 2 weeks since we've spoken. And we'll get to Romney's visit to Israel. Obviously, people want to know what you think of that, and there's plenty of news, Sinai, Syria, et cetera, and we'll try to get to all of that. But, you know, again, we find ourselves in this situation in the U.S. I don't know if you were in the country at the time, but obviously you're following the news. So the madman murders people at the Sikh temple. Does it lead someone like yourself to start thinking about armed guards at major synagogues in the United States?
We have long advocated not armed guards, but at least guards, and whether they come from within the synagogue community or outside. But it's essential, and at schools, it's essential. First, we extend our condolences to the Sikh community. I think that they are being victimized, claimed that since 9/11 they have been, though they have nothing to do with those responsible. They're obviously, an Indian community,
right,
and very peaceful. But the message should be clear to all of us. And, as many times as we have talked about it on the program, each incident is a reminder. What happened in Bulgaria is a reminder. We see the extent to which now Hezbollah has tried in more than 20 countries over the last 2 years, most recently Cyprus, in Thailand, in India, in Georgia, everywhere where they have tried to carry out attacks. And we shouldn't think that America is not vulnerable to the same thing. And developments in the Middle East could easily trigger some incident in Europe or elsewhere. We've had incidents in Europe already. We certainly have had attacks in the United States, right. Seattle, Los Angeles, other places, that the increasingly hostile rhetoric that we see from Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, Iran setting the pace, when Khamenei can show a map showing each city and how he's going to destroy it, when they talk in terms of the destruction of the Jewish state and often of the Jewish people, this is something that we should not be dismissive of, and they've carried it out.
We saw the statement by the member of parliament in Lebanon, who's a Hezbollah member, proclaiming that the increase of that the entire goal of full nuclear capability in Iran is simply to destroy the Israeli empire.
And we know that there have been traces now of many phone calls from Lebanon to Bulgaria, to the city where the attack took place. So linking them for the last 2 months, in fact, phone calls where they were coordinating this attack. And as you know, they tried one earlier in the year in the same place. So this is not a hypothetical danger. This is a real one. And people better take it seriously.
Yeah, and of course, as the high holidays approach, that's why we bring this issue up at the top of the list. All right, we'll start from what's a major curiosity among people in our community, because they'd love to get your take on it. The media had a certain way and continues to have a certain way of portraying Mitt Romney's visit to the Middle East. Could you give us your perspective on what you thought of the Republican nominee and spending Tisha B'Av in Israel and doing the fundraiser? And if, in fact, you could describe for us if the media painted an accurate picture.
Well, I don't think the media, obviously this is a political season and everything is seen through that lens, and people were looking for a gap because that's the only thing that makes news,
right.
A successful trip or only positive things doesn't make news. It's not interesting. And I think what happened in England, people, if you look at the full context of what he said, it wasn't terrible, but obviously everybody jumped on it, and in England people jumped on it, so it became a big story. In Israel, I think his desire to visit was fine, and he went to Poland as well. I don't know about the wisdom of doing the fundraiser. I don't know what it yielded or whether that should have been the focus of all the media coverage, and that the rest of his visit got very little attention, his speech about Jerusalem and at the Kotel, or the view of the Kotel, his visit there. Other things that they did, I think, were overshadowed by it, so...
What do you think of the impression that we're left with, again, by the media, that he shunned the PA or said things that were inappropriate?
Well, it's not inappropriate. And, he was making an analytical comment, whether it was phrased the best way in a political campaign to reference the culture of the Palestinians. But, look, the facts are facts. There's a society that preaches hatred to their kids, that indoctrinates them, and instead of educating them and teaching them high tech and helping advance their society and their chances to succeed and to move towards peace, you have too often a culture of hatred that is being promulgated, where you honor those who carry out suicide attacks, etc. whether the phrasing was smart and whether, you know, was exactly right, because his intent, I think, from what I read, was to say, look, the difference between when you look at one side of the green line and the other side of the border is the society that promotes development, education, and tries to focus on the youth and bettering their lives versus the situation in the Palestinian Authority. And you see many Palestinians who complain about the same thing. So that was the reference.
Right.
Again, the phrasing and stuff is something that they'll debate well into the next year.
Yeah, strictly from an analysis, I mean, like I always ask you, from your political science point of view, aren't you shocked, especially with conditions economically in this country, that the polls right now essentially this week are 49-40 and that this race is not tightening up this summer?
Well, first of all, the races really tighten up after the conventions. We have to see who he chooses as vice president. That gets a temporary blip usually, and then we'll have to see. But I think this year the debates are going to be very important, because the fact is that there are only a few states in play, and those states will be critical, including Pennsylvania, Ohio, places, Florida. We have Jewish communities that are significant. You know, in New York, we don't see any presidential advertising. There are periodic visits by the president and by Governor Romney, but you don't really see the heavy dose of advertising, all these hundreds of millions of dollars that are being spent, because if you lived in Ohio, Pennsylvania, believe me, you would know it.
I laugh because, as you know, last weekend we were in Florida, and it's one after the other, after the other, after the other. It's just nonstop.
And exactly, and but people say to me, you know, how come nobody's advertising this? Because you live in the wrong zip code, and the manifestations of this are really quite interesting. But you know, there'll be shifts, and people who watch it day to day, I keep telling them it's a mistake. You don't look at all of the facts, because in the next 3 months things could change dramatically, and it's a lifetime in politics. And this time, I think the debates are going to be very important in putting forward their case. And the fact is that the Obama campaign has outspent the Romney campaign, and Romney has more cash on hand, and that they're both spending all of this time fundraising primarily,
right,
and the attack ads. But at some point, we're going to have to get to substance.
From an analytics standpoint, though, what makes this even more interesting, you just mentioned how important the debates will be. It seems that the number of undecided voters at this point is much less than last time, which of course would take the focus a little bit more off the debates, and it would really turn attention more to core value issues.
I think that's true. There is a smaller undecided, but you know, historically, no president got reelected when unemployment, I think, was over 8.5 or
right.
over 8%.
Right.
Again, I don't think that you can make general rules. People are going to judge the candidates, and they're going to have to see, is there an alternative to President Obama that want to weigh the choices? I think that, you know, the silly season gets caught on such minutia where the core issues really get overlooked. But ultimately, when you go into the voting booth, that's really what dominates.
Malcolm Holmline with us. We call it the Weekly Update. Information about the Weekly Update podcast, if you go to jmnam.org, in the news section on the homepage, you'll find information about having it delivered straight to your iTunes. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning Radio program, heard and listener-sponsored, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. And before we get to the Sinai, which we will in a minute, now, I just feel like I have to ask you this because the deadline has passed. We haven't spoken since before August 1st. Any news on the Tal law, or essentially, as you predicted, basically everyone's ignoring the situation at this point?
Well, they're not ignoring it. They are moving ahead, but the showdown is yet to come as they try to enlist and recruit Haredi men, and many people have said they'll go to jail. They'll take thousands of people to jail. We have to see. Hopefully, they'll find a way to work this out, that those who can serve should serve, and that we resolve this without confrontation or without
disruption. Would you agree that certain leaders, and again, we've got to be careful, you know, how and when we criticize people, especially those recognized as Torah giants, but wouldn't you agree that sometimes one must avoid the exaggeration and not make statements like they're trying to close all the yeshivas and things like that?
I think in this kind of a debate, there's rhetoric on all sides. I mean, there are government officials, there's others who use really harsh language, and there are some in the religious community too who resort to, as you said, exaggeration. I think that the there are sincere concerns. I think that there are legitimate issues on both sides about the need for everyone to contribute, everyone to serve the country. Learning is a way to serve the country too. But the you know, when this whole idea was first projected, when Ben Gurion reached the agreement, you were talking about hundreds,
right,
maybe expecting that it'll grow to a few thousand.
While we're on the topic, sorry about that. While we're on the topic, did you enjoy the Siyum HaShas?
I think it was an amazing event. I think that the Aguda and all of those involved deserve, lay people and professionals deserve tremendous credit. I think everything within their control was organized very well. They couldn't control the traffic, but even that in the end worked out. As you saw the stadium fill up, it was a remarkable demonstration of Achdus. And while it's painted as a Haredi or similar event, the fact is that when we looked down on the crowd, you saw every kind of yarmulke possible. You saw every kind of hat possible. We saw the immense derech eretz that was demonstrated, the way people behaved. As one of the guards said to me on the way out, one of the officials actually said that there wasn't a single incident inside the stadium. And they were so wonderful on the way out, saying thank you for coming. I never heard that at a sports event or an event, but they were. And there was a woman, I was told, and people told stories of how they would keep track of how many people said thank you to them as they left the stadium.
Wow.
To the guards.
That's a good one.
And that was really a remarkable demonstration on the part of people. And I saw, even going in and going up the stairs and all of that, people were polite. People didn't push and shove. I mean, there were a few exceptions, but we have their names.
Now, you
know who you are if you're listening.
Yeah, exactly. You described the type of guests that you were escorting that evening. Did they appreciate it?
Pardon me?
You described the type of guests, Jewish leadership, some in the very mainstream Jewish world who would be with you that night. Did they appreciate it?
I think everybody was blown away by it.
All right, let's get back to the Middle East. So this is a difficult situation for a regular guy like me to understand. That's why we have you on the phone. So I would suspect that if now Egypt is being led by a representative of the Muslim Brotherhood, right, and essentially it is, correct?
Right.
That he now would be in control of the army, yet it is his army or the Egyptian army that's taking on these militant terrorists in the northern part of the Sinai?
Well, actually, you're not the only one that doesn't understand it. I'm not sure they understand it right now, but let me give you some of the background. First of all, what's very interesting when you ask, is it a Muslim Brotherhood government? He only appointed four members of Muslim Brotherhood to cabinet posts out of 30. He tried to make it diverse, a lot of technocrats. But look at the four that he chose: education, television, communications, commerce, youth, and culture. Guess who's building for the future? Not commerce, housing. Who is trying to control the future, the things that affect people, that give them real ultimate control? In terms of the army, the generals still are in control of the army. We'll have to see whether Morsi goes to the meeting in Iran,
right,
that they've convened of the non-aligned movement. This will, of course, take a toll on his relationship with Saudi Arabia and with us, which he needs very much. He has not yet, we have not yet seen what the ultimate commitment will be. This was a big embarrassment to him, this attack, coming from the Islamists in Sinai. But you remember that when I came back from Egypt, I reported on the show that the thing that the generals warned about most 16 months ago was about the Sinai.
Right.
And this is the first time that you've had this kind of incident, especially with the Egyptians striking back by air, since 1973. Now, Hamas is trying to deny, we'll come to Hamas in a minute, but the groups involved here are varied, but the common thread in this is Iran. He tried to reach out to Iran. Remember that he even hosted Haniyeh of Hamas. That love affair, I think, is going to be much more short-lived than people thought it would be. The Egyptians now are have to go through this process of assessment. On the one hand, they're trying to take control. They fired the 50 editors of state-controlled newspapers, etc. They also sacked the intelligence chief, the governor of North Sinai, other generals, because of the attack in Sinai. That's exactly what Erdogan did. He went after the media, he goes after the generals, he tries to take control. It's a Muslim Brotherhood scenario, and we're seeing it there. Israel warned them about this attack, and they admitted that they got the warning, but they said that Muslims wouldn't attack Muslims during Ramadan, and so they more or less dismissed it. We are seeing some cooperation between Israel and Egypt, perhaps better than people generally assume on the intelligence and military level about controlling events in Sinai. Mm-hmm. For Israel to give in on the request of the Egyptians to allow the attack helicopters, which they did, but also to increase largely the number of troops that they allow into Sinai to take control. On the one hand, obviously, they want to see that happen. On the other hand, you're letting a Muslim Brotherhood government put thousands of troops that could end up on Israel's border. The president of Egypt hosted the vice president of Iran about 2 days ago, 3 days ago. This is the highest level visit. So he's playing both sides in both ways. He goes to Saudi Arabia, etc. But what we're seeing is a very complex situation, combination of factors that come into play. So while, you know, you say it's hard to assess it, it's very hard for everybody to assess it. And I'm not sure that the players on the team are quite clear. This was a big attack, 35 people involved. And they showed that they had the real military experience. Six of them had explosive belts. I mean, they were really going in to kill Israelis. And Israel is going to ask Egypt now to build a barrier or a ditch along the border to try and prevent any kind of vehicle from coming across. But this is a story that we've only seen the beginning of. So, you know that Egypt does not allow Irani or Iraqi citizens into the country.
So, I mean, this just struck me, but it may be overstating the obvious. So, basically, Gaza moved a little bit south.
Well, we have now what might be Somalia, what might be expanded Gaza. You have the Salafists, the extremists there, influencing the Bedouin. And some Bedouin now are becoming Salafists. That was never their tradition. And many of the tribal leaders in the Bedouin communities are protesting what's happening in the Sinai now. I mean, you know, they made their living smuggling and stealing, robbing, whatever they do, but they are uncomfortable now with the development because this can obviously flare up. It affects their lives as well.
Let me state it a little differently. If the Israeli military still had the capability and the freedom to operate in Gaza the way they did before 7 years ago, could this situation, even though it's not exactly in Gaza, it's south of it, could it have been avoided?
Well, the breakdown in Libya enabled a huge stockpile of weapons. The revolution in Egypt allowed them to destroy whatever police infrastructure, et cetera, was there. Those are not things that Israel could have changed, even if they had an increased presence in Gaza. Mm. What might have been different in Gaza is that you wouldn't have this as a base of operation. They used the tunnels that go from Gaza to Egypt to stage this raid, so that the Egyptians that went and blew them up. And by the way, you know, they closed the crossings from Gaza to Egypt. I wonder if there'll be flotillas now to protest Egypt's closing often of Gaza.
Yeah.
Want to take bets?
UN condemnation. Yeah, I know which side I'd bet on that one. So now explain Netanyahu. If I understood you correctly a couple of minutes back, he actually had to, or the defense minister's office or foreign minister's office, had to actually give permission for Egypt's military to act in a certain way?
Not to act, but to allow in the Camp David Accords restrict the number of troops and what equipment they can have. And they need special permission from Israel in order to change that, to amend it, to allow increased numbers.
I mean, is that a big deal? Does this show us that there is cooperation between Egypt and Israel, or that was an automatic, so to speak?
Well, it's not an automatic because, as I said, it poses also dangers ultimately in Israel once you raise the numbers.
Right, understood. But what I mean by automatic is that Israel had no choice because of the situation.
Because you can't ask them to control the situation. You can't ask them to, and Israel doesn't want to go in and do it.
Right.
So you've got to let the Egyptian military, and hopefully the military leadership will stay intact and can resist the attempts by Morsi to eviscerate them, as was done in Turkey and elsewhere.
Because one of the big curiosities, of course, since the fall of Mubarak has been, what is the future of the relationship between Israel and Egypt? If, in fact, they end up with a common enemy in Sinai, they may be more cooperative than we thought they'd be.
they may end up out of necessity being more cooperative, but we haven't seen the true face of this yet, and right. we certainly, this is an evolving situation. You saw in Libya how in the elections for parliament, the more moderate forces emerged victorious. We've seen a country like Morocco, where the king took a very enlightened approach, and you have a fundamentalist Muslim Brotherhood prime minister. They won the election, but they're not able to institute because the king exercises ultimate control. So each country has its own model and they're all evolving. We don't know what the ultimate outcome will be in Egypt. It is a very tenuous and potentially dangerous situation.
All right, so now back to my original question. Does the president of Egypt now have control over his army?
The army, the generals have control over the army. The president is going to exercise more control and firing his intelligence chief and some military people to be the scapegoats for this attack is the first salvo, I think, in his efforts. But we saw them we will see more in the writing of the Constitution and other ways that, as Turkey did, to legally restrict them and to try and, he appointed Tantawi, the head of the army, as the Minister of Defense. So he needs them right now. But the question is, what powers he'll really ultimately allow them to have?
You think this is a big
or will they resist it?
You think this is a big week ahead? You think that Sinai could escalate again this week?
Well, Sinai is continuing. There have been some more attacks, and we know that there are more planned. So, I've discussed on the show with you for months. We've talked about a year. We've talked about the Sinai, what's going on there, whether it's Somalia because of Al-Qaeda being there and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. You have the global jihad organizations inside there operating. So it's not a surprise that it took place. It will continue to take place. This is not going to end very quickly. And what Israel has to shore up its defenses, as it has been for months, and building defense along the Egyptian border. But we don't know how many weapons came, not just from Libya, but from Sudan as well. And you have a radicalization of the population. The demonstrations that took place reflect that in this week, that it goes against Egypt as much as it goes against Israel.
Malcolm Homeline with us. All right, where is the Prime Minister of Syria?
Not in Syria.
Well, the reports say he's in Jordan, yeah. Which always fascinates me because I always thought Jordan is afraid to get involved in all this, but you've explained to me that that's not the case. So what is the situation? How are the rebels hanging on, and why hasn't Assad's army essentially just taken over Aleppo and done away with all these rebel groups?
Well, again, a complex situation. In terms of the defections, there have been many important people, including Syria's first astronaut, who have defected. 10 Sunni families, very prominent ones, defected this week. Those are one of his core support groups. So the situation on one hand is weakening, but frankly, I don't think that Assad cares so much what happens in Homa or Homs or other areas. I think he cares what happens in Aleppo and Damascus. If they fall, he falls. Now, Iran, as you know, convened a meeting on Syria. It was just to assure their role, and to one of the things that they want to assure in turn is that Assad remains in power. They don't want to see a transition. They obviously don't want to see their investment and the use of Syria as a puppet state to transfer weapons to Hezbollah, to et cetera, et cetera. We know that they have increased the number of troops. There's estimates that there are 15,000 Iranian troops fighting in Syria. Those, you saw what happened with these guys who came under the guise of being pilgrims and were captured by the Free Syrian Army, and now they're saying they're all Hezbollah. They are all Iran Revolutionary Guard and Basij, who are the militia groups. In fact, one of them, General, reported 3,000 Syrian troops came through Damascus Airport early this week in just a few days. So the situation in Syria, where you have the continuing killing, the blanket attacks, the feeling that there's no real force that will stop them, because as long as Russia and others back them, and Russia and China came to the meeting in Iran, it was not, I think, ever intended to be a serious meeting.
Right.
Or,
that's why I ask, especially with their neighbor's permission, that's why I ask, doesn't Assad have the military power to end this situation now?
The question is whether he has the ongoing military power to control the situation. And, you know, Iran, Syria has huge amounts of weapons. All along, the talk had been about the biological and chemical weapons, which have huge stockpiles. And I saw an estimate that it would take 75,000 troops to really control all of these situations. I think it's probably much less. But the Europeans and the Americans this week were talking about the conventional weapons, like shoulder-fired missiles, which pose a threat to every airport, to every, you know, flying plane, to other targets, talking about how they would control the conventional weapons in Syria should there be a collapse, or should the army... I mean, it just takes the defection of soldiers who are guarding any of these locations to make them vulnerable to being exploited. And we know who's sitting there, Hezbollah and others, ready to do just that. There's also a lot of concern about Iraq's role coming in this play. And they did a thing with Hezbollah, which I hope we'll talk about for a minute, but it tells us why this the situation vis-a-vis Iraq and its relationship with Iran, especially with the withdrawal of U.S. troops, is so high on the priorities of the different countries. Jordan has taken 120,000 of these people. Jordan is a target for them, and the fear always is that they will use this to destabilize the country. The Jordanian country, which has its own Muslim Brotherhood problem.
What about infiltration from Syria on the Israeli-Syrian border?
What about what? Say it again.
Infiltration from Syria on the Israeli-Syrian border.
There was one crossing by troops last week. There has been no attempts, serious attempts, but Israel has increased its presence along the Golan border. The fear is that if there's a collapse, it's not so much that refugees would come to Israel. They're going to, obviously, to Turkey. They're going. Some of them try to go to Lebanon, although they sort of sealed the border with Lebanon. The likelihood is, they go to Jordan and to the areas along the Turkish-Syrian border, which has now become a subject also of increased tension and concern.
I could only imagine. The NIE report that gets to President Obama's desk says Iran has made significant and surprising progress toward military nuclear capability. Does the word surprising surprise you in that statement?
So that's the issue. Why is it surprising? And we don't know whether it's an NIE, National Intelligence Estimate, which, if you remember, in 2007, the National Intelligence Estimate said that in 2003, 2004, it stopped, and therefore it's not such a threat, and completely distorted both the reality and held back a lot of the efforts because it became a cover for those who did not want to do anything on Iran. Now they're saying it's surprising. It's not surprising because Ahmadinejad himself declared last week they have 11,000 centrifuges operating. So nobody should have been surprised by the fact, but they're saying it's significant and faster development of these centrifuges. Well, Israel's been saying it all along, and Barak said this brings them closer in line with Israel. Now, question is, where the administration, the critical thing boils down to one word, and that's capability. Is it the capability to develop weapon or actually the possession of weapons? And the president made a strong statement yesterday, but again, talked about now not allowing them from acquiring or having a nuclear weapon, not the capability, which is what Israel focuses on. Because once you have the capability, you can always bypass or come back to it or whatever, to have that, to ultimately have the weapon. And just think, if in these situations you would have had a Hamas with access to nuclear weapons of some kind, or if Syria had them or whatever, the situations in all these countries or some of the attacks that we've seen might have been very different and obviously are of great concern. So the Iranian situation is very interesting. They're hosting this non-aligned movement. It's going to be interesting to see who comes. Everybody who knows the government should write them and tell them not to go there. Whether we will see increased action in view of the new estimate and whether the Europeans and others will help to escalate the implementation of sanctions, but recognizing that is not the answer to the problem ultimately.
Well,
the United States and the Gulf countries, by the way, are building a regional missile defense system to protect bases and refineries. Well, that tells us that they're already planning for the fact that this is a reality.
Where is it located?
That's the wrong message.
Where is it located?
It'll be in the Gulf countries, in Saudi Arabia,
Wow.
And the United States is a partner with them. And as you know, we have it in Israel, and the United States upgraded some of the capacity that Israel will have. They have it in Turkey as well. So it's sort of becoming a regional network. But the question is, does this message say that we're accepting the fact that Iran will be allowed to get it ultimately, or will have it ultimately,
right,
or is it a protection against the conventional capacity that Iran already possesses, and we know that they're certainly ready to make trouble?
Unbelievable. All right, Malcolm, you with us next week?
God willing.
Enjoy the trip.
From no undisclosed location in Brooklyn, but God willing, I will, and I will be happy to report on the rest of the trip then. And I urge people who have the chance to visit Morocco to do so.
There's a nice plug. There you go. Malcolm Holmline from Morocco. He's Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.